Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Will the Tucson Massacre begin an era of toned-down political discourse in America, or might it be the first in a tragic wave of assassinations like in the 1960s? Those are some of the questions that New York Times political columnist Matt Bai asked in a piece on Sunday. He joins us now to look at America as teetering on a ledge between more civility and more violence. Hi, Matt. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thank you. Nice to be here.
You began your article with Sarah Palin's now infamous crosshairs map quickly being removed from the internet over the weekend, and later to candidate Sharon Angle's statement about Second Amendment remedies, as she put it, if necessary. You also refer to a lesser-known campaign commercial for an Alabama Republican congressional candidate this fall that used the phrase, gather your armies. Who was that, and what was the context of that?
His name was Rick Barber, and by the way, Brian, just I'm having a little bit of an echo in my ear, so if this is just anybody who can fix it, that'd be great.
We'll work on that.
There it goes. We're good. There was an ad by Rick Barber who ran for Congress. He had a primary campaign in Alabama, and what it shows is a bunch of guys dressed up as sort of the patriots of the revolution around the table, and he explains the challenge they're facing with the health care law and the sort of tyranny in Washington. And George Washington says at the end of the ad, gather your armies. What I would say about this, Brian, I've been watching the debate since I wrote that column in the last couple of days, is that there are two distinct strains here that I think we should separate out. One is the language and imagery of violence, which is pretty much self-explanatory. I don't think it has any place in politics. I don't think it's constructive, and I think most people agree, and I think at this point, there'll be some reevaluation of a lot of that imagery and language. The other is this notion that politicians who serve in Washington are somehow other, they're somehow less than human, they're oppressors, they're tyrants, they're not like us, they're not like other people, and that somehow they are dangerous to the cause of American freedom. This rhetoric isn't necessarily violent, but I think it is just as, if not more, contributory to the kind of mood you have in the country. I don't know that it has anything to do with this shooting, except that I think it's very easy in this environment for anybody who pays attention to the broader media to look at a Washington politician, at a congressperson or a senator, and say, that person is nothing like me and presents a threat to my ideal of what the country is. That person isn't even really a human being. And I think that's the kind of rhetoric, even as much as any talk of violence, that we ought to be talking about in the wake of the shooting.
Do you think then that by its nature, the Tea Party with that colonial imagery implies violent overthrow of a tyrannical regime like the Revolutionary War against England begun by the Tea Party?
I've no doubt for some people it does. Now, I want to be really clear about this because I've met a lot of Tea Party folks. I've spent time with them. I was out in Utah and did a piece about the Tea Party leader there. In that piece, I made the point, this is just before the election, that a lot of these folks are very much like their counterparts on the left. I mean, not ideologically, but in terms of their desire to have civic engagement and change politics. I think the vast majority of people engaged in this movement online or in their communities are trying to change the country in a constructive way. And I don't think it is a movement shot through with violence or shot through with with hatred. But you always have a fringe element of people. Certainly in a movement like this, which appeals to the right, you're more likely to have people who own guns. You're more likely to have people who are anti-government types, militia types, who are attracted to that ideology. And I think this constant reiteration of the idea that we are in a pre-insurrection state, that we are in a revolutionary period like we were in the 18th century, that there are oppressors and tyrants who need to be overthrown and checked against. I do think it's damaging. I do think it contributes. I don't think it's the only thing that contributes, and I don't think this is purely a right-wing problem, frankly. But I think it's very, very unhelpful, and probably inevitably the period like the one we've just been through on all sides was going to lead to some form of violence. I felt that way before, and I'm not convinced we're through it.
Have you been looking for signs of political context in the motive of the shooter? The duality that's discussed in the press seems to be either political or crazy, or maybe there's some combination. Do you have any kind of beginnings of an answer for yourself?
Well, we don't have the information yet. I mean, the likelihood that it's a little of both, as you point out, Brian, is pretty good. And the likelihood that he has any cohesive political argument to make isn't very good. And by the way, as you know, most assassins and would-be assassins don't have a terribly cohesive political ideology if you look historically. I mean,
right.
it's not something that sane people do, in other words. It's not a sane way to deal with political dialogue. At the same time,
although people do commit political crimes of violence and political assassinations. I mean,
absolutely, but you know, it's different. I mean, Sirhan, for instance, you know, talking about an issue of sort of obscurity in the American debate, you know, did not assassinate Robert Kennedy because his opposition to Vietnam was a danger to the country. You know, I mean, it tends not to be necessarily the mainstream argument at the moment. You know, that said, I don't think that's an excuse to then say, well, the two things are disconnected. Like, if he's not, you know, if he's not following the political line of the Tea Party, then why are we even discussing this? I think we're discussing it because, I think as your question implies, all of this bleeds into the mood and the atmosphere in the country and the sense of urgency. And I really think that's the thing I tried to get across in my column that I've been trying to get across talking about this, is it is the difference between having a debate and political philosophy and constantly communicating to people, particularly people who are unstable or who are on the fringe or who feel deeply threatened and frustrated in their lives, that this is an Armageddon, that this is the end-all be-all, that it either goes one way or the other, and the fate of the republic and the fate of our children rests on it. That kind of overheated rhetoric, and it's on cable TV every night, it's on blogs of both ideologies every night, that kind of rhetoric is inevitably leads people to see themselves as actors in a grand human historic drama in a way that I think it becomes closely linked to a tendency toward violence.
Along those lines, I want to play an exchange from Fox News Sunday between NPR's Mara Liasson and Fox's Brit Hume on their weekly roundtable. The topic is what kind of speech is inflammatory. Mara speaks first.
And today, I want to tell you, I hope that all Americans are saddened.
My apologies, that was the wrong clip. That was Sheriff Dubnyk in Arizona. Now to the Mara Liasson Brit Hume.
I do think it's going to make people think twice before they use certain metaphors in politics, like fascists, socialists,
right.
Nazis. I mean, I think people are going to have to think, not because that this kind of rhetoric caused it, but I think it is going to have a kind of cautionary and positive effect.
Does it change
the... Let me draw one line of distinction. If you want to call someone a fascist, that's one thing. I think that's obviously over the top. We know that fascism is not abroad in the land. And Nazis, similarly. But if you want to argue that someone's a socialist, there are people on Capitol Hill who are declared socialists, Mara. That's nothing wrong with that.
But the kinds of things that we would defend our country using military means against. Some people would defend our country against communists and socialists using military
means. Last word.
So I'm just curious. NPR's Mara Liasson, they're expressing her opinion on Fox News with their Brit Hume. Does that exchange define some of the bounds of this debate or maybe the impossibility of this debate? You can say socialism but not fascism. You can't say fascist even if you think George Bush or whoever is one. Where does this all lead?
I think it's going to be an ongoing debate. I think Brit Hume raises a point there. I used socialism in my column and thought about it consequently and thought, well, socialism and communism aren't quite the same thing. I mean, we do have to try to be as precise and as accurate as we can, and that'll be an ongoing conversation. But I think to the extent that anything good comes out of this, I don't know if Mara's right, that it will have a huge impact, and I don't know that anything good comes out of something this horrific. But to the extent that anything good comes out of it, I think you will have more public pressure and media pressure. I think it will be harder for people to use these terms like fascism, like communism, to say that someone's not a real American, to say that someone wants to, or the kind of Sarah Palin-ish rhetoric, right, the don't retreat, reload. I think there's going to be a different standard. I think people are going to say, well, look at what happened in Arizona, and to the extent that you know, we begin to self-impose a kind of guideline, a kind of sensitivity to what this rhetoric can contribute, I think that's important. Because, as you know, Brian, this isn't just about the political dialogue. It's not just about politicians. You know, we see this in the media. I see it in the mail I get. You probably see it in the mail you get. We have, as a society, gotten away from the value of our words. It's a lot easier to get words around than it used to be, and there's a lot more of them out there, and we tend to think they don't matter.
Do you think
and we tend to think that you have to exaggerate to be heard, and it's not healthy.
Matt Bye, Political Times columnist for the New York Times. And do you think that this goes equally to both sides? Paul Krugman in his Times column yesterday said that, in his opinion, there really is not an equivalency between what Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann do on MSNBC and what somebody like O'Reilly or somebody like Beck does, that you know, those on the right really are more inciting in their language, and those on the left hold it just to mockery. On the other hand, you have people pointing out instances of this. On the left, there was another website that was taken down that you referred to, a webpage on Daily Kos, where somebody said previously that Gabrielle Giffords was, quote, dead to me from a liberal in her district because she had taken a position on an issue. You have Barack Obama himself during the campaign when, you know, there was some reference to a knife. He said, well, if they bring a knife, we'll bring a gun. And all he meant it was in political terms. But do you think everybody does it, or do you think this is more of a right-wing issue?
Well, I think, you know, I've gotten a fair amount of mail about this. I read Paul Krugman's column. I think the left sets up a false sort of binary choice here. What the critics on the left that you refer to are effectively saying is, it's not the same thing. We're not as bad. We don't encourage violence. Therefore, we have no part in it. And I don't think it has to be one or the other. Either you're just as inflammatory or you're perfect. I think we have to accept varying levels of responsibility. And as you know, during the Bush years, there was hatred and vitriol on liberal blogs every day. Now, it didn't seem like hatred and vitriol to those folks because they thought they were right, and they thought it was self-evident that they were right. But they talked about him as a traitor to their country. They talked about him as someone who didn't care about the death of soldiers, as someone who lied, as someone who designed the attack on 9/11, all kinds of things. So, you know, is there the same rhetoric of violence that you find, that we have found examples of with Sarah Palin and others and with the Tea Party, on liberal blogs every day or among liberal commentators on MSNBC? No, I don't think so, and I think that should be pointed out. But it is a time to reevaluate all of our rhetoric and the difference between portraying your enemies as philosophical opponents or as actual enemies, as actually human adversaries. And I think, you know, for the left to say that's not their problem and doesn't exist in their venues of communication, I think it's a cop-out, and I don't think it's helpful.
Before you go, what about for the politicians themselves heading into this next election cycle, including the presidential election cycle? You mentioned Sarah Palin, and I referred earlier to her, and I also want to correct again something that I erroneously said before, which was that she sent a one-line email to Glenn Beck in response to all the criticism of her crosshairs map. It was more than a one-line email. Mm-hmm. They had an exchange of email, one line of which got more widely circulated, and so my error in saying she sent a one-line, only a one-line response to this. But does it make Sarah Palin change? Does it help or hurt her politically as she presumably runs for the president? Does it help or hurt any other Republican candidate or President Obama?
I mean, look, my view on this, and I feel strongly about it, as you can tell, Brian, and I think it's true across the political spectrum. Politicians need to lead. They're leaders. They're not followers. The best politicians, the ones we remember, right, throughout our history, from, you know, the earliest presidents of the republic to more modern presidents like Ronald Reagan or this president when he campaigned and the way that he inspired people, politicians who inspire people and who have lasting legacies lead by channeling the more destructive and extreme elements in their party. They don't lead by pandering to them. And we are at a moment, because of the blogs and the cable TV, and also because of the shrinking primary electorates, which create a much greater tendency toward pandering to extremes, we are in a moment where politicians too often pander and don't lead, and too often tell people what they want to hear. And by the way, it's not just politicians. Let's be fair. It's columnists. It's talk show hosts. It's people in my business, right? It's very tempting to hear the applause and to confirm the worst fears that people have rather than to try to confront their worldviews. And the question you're effectively asking is, are we going to get more leadership and less pandering? I don't know the answer, but I don't think the country's going to get past the kind of dialogue or the lack of progress in several areas we've had until that happens.
Matt Bai, political columnist for The New York Times. His article in Sunday's paper was headlined, "A Turning Point in the Discourse, But in Which Direction?" Thank you so much.
Anytime. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And at this moment, Mayor Bloomberg is holding a news conference to talk in large measure about gun laws that he would like to see in response to the Arizona shooting. We will play some excerpts from that in just a minute and get a response from Congressman Bill Pascrell of New Jersey. Stay with us.